Howdy, howdy, howdy. You are listening to Cool Things to Think About. My name is Justin Chitla. The goal of my podcast is to share cool podcast bits and YouTube snippets that will honestly be about anything that I find interesting or cool to think about. Welcome. Okay, episode 2, a short 3-4 months later. I don't know what to say. Just making excuses for myself, getting into a good groove at work, enjoying what I'm doing, and trying to find time to hang out with my friends. That's all I can say. But I want to do this. This is really fun. So I am changing my goal to try to make one episode every month. We'll see how it goes. I'll try my best. Anyways, this episode is going to be about understanding. Why? I think as lifelong learners, it is important to kind of do a little reflection to see if your version of understanding is what you believe it to be. The first clip is going to be an excerpt from a YouTube video that is a collage of clips from one of my favorite human beings of all time, Richard Feynman. All links in the show notes, of course.
Well, that was a kid, I invented a problem for myself, the sum of the powers of the integers. And in trying to get the formula for it, I developed a certain set of numbers that I, for formula for which I couldn't get. And I discovered later that those were known as the Bernoulli numbers and discovered in 1739. So I was up to 1739 when I was about 14, you see. And then a little later, I discovered something I'd find out. I just may have invented a thing called, which we now call, operator calculus, and that was invented in 1890 something. You see, I was inventing things that came later and later. But the moment when I began to realize that I was now working on something new was when I read about quantum electrodynamics at the time, and I read a book and I learned about it. For example, I read Dirac's book, and he had these problems that nobody knew how to solve and were described there. I couldn't understand the book very well because I really wasn't up to it. But there, in the last paragraph at the end of the book, it said, some new ideas are here needed. And so there I was. Some new ideas were needed. Okay, so I started to think of new ideas.
Kid said to me, say, what's that bird? What's the name of it? Do you know the name of that bird? I says, I'm the slightest idea. He said, well, it's a brown-throated thrush. He says, your father doesn't teach you anything. But my father had already taught me about the names of birds. Once we walked in, he says, that's a brown-throated thrush. He says, know what the name of that bird is? A brown-throated thrush. In German, it's called a Fliegenflügel. In Chinese, it's called a Qinglongtong. In Japanese, a Tohatohara, and so on. And it, when you know all the names in every language of that bird, you know nothing, but absolutely nothing about the bird. And then we would go on and talk about the pecking and the feathers. So I had learned already that names don't constitute knowledge. To knowing the name of something. That's caused me a certain trouble since, because I refuse to learn the name of anything. So when someone comes in and says, you got any explanation for the Fitzcronin experiment? I says, what's that? He says, you know, that the long-lived K-meson disintegrates into two pies. Oh, yes, now I know. But I never know the names of things. What he forgot to tell me was that knowing the names of things is useful if you want to talk to somebody else. So you tell him what you're talking about.
If there is one person I wish I could have met from the past, it is definitely this guy, Richard Feynman, by a large margin. Just listening to him, you can tell that he has such a unique perspective of the world. He learned about the world in a way that everyone should, in a way that I am very envious of. He didn't go into, let's say, math like most of us do. We are kind of thrown into a process of learning math that right off the bat feels very forced and unintuitive. A lot of the time in school, we are told subjects and not really shown them. For math, we are told that, you know, we learn numbers and fancy equations and are drilled on doing them to perfection rather than being shown that math is a language for understanding all the patterns that you see in nature, in physics, in everything really. And here in the first half of the clip, you can see that by having a problem first, by actually being curious about the world around him and finding a problem. In his case, this was trying to solve for the sum of the powers of integers, he was able to work to it and create a pattern that satisfied this problem. This pattern he later found out to be the Bernoulli numbers, or the set of Bernoulli numbers. It takes a special type of person to be so curious to learn in this way, in a way where you are grounded by first principles of thinking, you know, unbothered by everyone else's thoughts and ideas. Just letting yourself experiment until you come to a solution. And I think really the best people, you know, the people that inspire me to be a better version of myself have three traits. And those traits are curiosity, humility, and empathy. And I think this clip did a great job at showing you someone who is naturally just super curious about the world around him. Cool. Onward to the next clip, which is a TED Talk. I love TED Talks, so you're probably going to be seeing a lot of clips and excerpts from TED Talks in the future, by Philip Fernbach, on why we believe things that aren't true. I thought this was cool to throw into the mix because we can see that in reality, almost all of our understanding of the world isn't super deep or real.
As individuals, we do not know enough to justify almost anything we believe. Now, I know that might sound crazy to you, but let's think about a couple really obvious facts. We all believe that the Earth revolves around the sun. Of course we do. It's the most basic fact in the world. But on what basis? Can you explain the astronomical observations that support that belief? I know I can. What about smoking? We all know it's terrible for us, right? But what's actually in cigarette smoke that's bad? And what does it do to our bodies and our cells? What's cancer really? How does it even form? These are not isolated examples. Most of what we believe is not based on what's in our heads. And there's a good reason for that. There's not much in our heads. As human beings, we are just not made to store a lot of detailed information. In the 1980s, a psychologist named Thomas Landauer set out to estimate the size of an individual's knowledge base in bytes, the same scale that's used to measure computer memories. One approach he took was to analyze the result of memory experiments, where people are asked to study some pictures or words or bits of music, and then later tested to see if they recognize them. Using the data, he was able to estimate the rate at which we can acquire knowledge, and also the rate at which we forget what we learn. And then he extrapolated to a 70-year lifespan. So, how much do you know? Landauer's estimate? 1 gigabyte. I think this is an amazing result. Mind-blowing, really. 1 gigabyte is a tiny amount. By comparison, you can buy a thumb drive on Amazon.com for less than 18 bucks that holds 64 gigabytes. Now, at this point, some of you guys might be freaking out a little bit, feeling a little bit concerned. After all, we all think it's the most important thing in the world to know a lot and have great memories. But really, this is a misconception. We do not have to know a lot because we're not made to think on our own. It's natural to think about thinking as what happens between your ears, but that's not where the magic really happens. This video comes from a psychologist by the name of Michael Tomasello and his colleagues. They study human children's cognitive abilities in comparison to other animals like chimpanzees. The goal is to understand what really makes us special. What abilities do we excel at that other animals just cannot master? You see how easily this young child reads the mind of the experimenter and then figures out how to coordinate his behavior to achieve the goal. He even makes eye contact at the end, as if to say, "I've got your back, man." This is so natural to us that it seems like nothing, but it's actually incredibly difficult to design a cognitive system that's capable of collaboration. This is really the secret to our success. It's what separates us from all other thinking creatures. Chimpanzees routinely fail at tasks that require sharing knowledge and working together to pursue goals, tasks that young children master with ease. Now, the real tragedy occurs in how we relate to people who have different beliefs than us. We live in the illusion that we have arrived at our own positions via a serious analysis, and that we can support and justify what we believe based on what we know. Therefore, when someone doesn't believe what we believe, it's obvious what the problem is. They're too stupid to see the truth. And there's actually a sense in which you're right when you think that. It's true. They did not arrive at their position via a rational process of evidence evaluation. And they don't understand the issue in depth. But neither do you. Think about how we talk about a complex issue like healthcare. If you're a liberal, the Affordable Care Act is the bee's knees. If you're a conservative, it's destroying America. But most of the time, arguments about the policy's merits amount to little more than repetition of sound bites that we heard from someone else. As non-experts, we can't possibly do justice to the complexity of an issue like that. When we express our beliefs, we are all just channeling our communities of knowledge. That's what we do. Knowledge is not in my head, and it's not in your head. Knowledge is shared, and therefore, the things that you really care about, those things are shared too.
Okay, so what did you have to think about that? We do not know enough to justify almost anything we believe. This is so crazy to hear, but I think it's true. We specialize in what we want to dig deeper into understanding, but there are too many things out there that we have to try to learn and try to come up with beliefs and ideas on our own. And I know that we don't have the time to go back and reason our way through everything that has been discovered since the beginning of time. So in this video, Philip is telling us that we really don't know a lot about anything. This is just a sad video if he's telling us that we don't know anything and we just simply can't know everything. Well, we have to practice intellectual humility. We have to try harder at understanding where others are coming from, because in reality, we all learn about most things in the same way, which is by hearing other people talking about it. So what does this mean to be practicing intellectual humility? Well, for starters, you know, we don't have to act so sure of ourselves about everything. It is okay to not know something. We do have to take stances on issues we don't fully understand, right? But we need to be surrounded by a community that values and honors truth and real understanding, right? With this, we are going to get things right most of the time. All right, practice intellectual humility. Seriously, like this week, if you and someone else disagree on something, maybe just kick off a lifelong journey of practicing more humility, practicing being a better person. Just agree with them and admit that you're wrong. I don't care what it is. Just feel what it's like to let go of our stubbornness in being correct and being smart. What's the worst thing that can happen? You know, why do we hate being wrong so much? I don't get it.
As I said, I'm a mediator. When people are at war, they come to me, and I help them work it out. Not too long ago, I was visited by a couple that had already been divorced. The ex-wife, Sophia, said a precious object had gone missing. What was it? Sophia had never met her father, and her mother died when she was a little girl. She was raised by her grandmother. And in her grandmother's house hung this large painting, painted by Sophia's grandmother of Sophia's mother. Sophia used to look at this painting when she was a little girl and imagine herself holding her mom's hand and kissing her mom's cheek. Sophia's grandmother, the painter, died a few weeks before the mediation. And in her final hours, she signed the picture. Sophia described this with tears and finally looked to her ex-husband and she said, Frank took the picture. Frank, when are you going to stop trying to punish me for the affair? I looked at the guy, and his face was cold as stone, and I thought, whoa. People come to see me because I can help solve their problems, but I'm kind of a one-trick pony. The thing is, I have this excellent trick. I can help them understand each other's hidden motivations. And I knew something that Sophia didn't. Frank wasn't trying to punish her. People often think revenge is a human motive, but hurting another person is not a human need. Now, how do I know? Well, here's a trick I developed a few years ago that I find very useful. If you ever think that somebody is motivated by something that doesn't personally give you pleasure, you actually haven't found their motivation. Go deeper. I don't get pleasure from hurting other people. If it's not in me, it's not a common need. And if it's not a common need, it's not a human motivation. Go deeper. Revenge is pursued to fulfill another need. But what? It varies, but very often it's a need for understanding. If I hurt you, you will understand at the level of personal pain, at the level of intense personal suffering, what you did to me. You'll finally get it. This wasn't the case for Frank. My theory that he had taken the picture in order to be understood for the pain of the affair was wrong. I often guess wrong. But that I was guessing and without blame convinced him to share something else. His eyes welled with tears, and he looked over at his ex-wife, Sophia, and he said, "Soph, she had become my grandmother too. She was all that I had. You were all that I had." Frank was an orphan too, just like Sophia. He took the painting to fulfill a common human need of connection. Hurting Sophia was never the point. Sophia moved next to Frank on the couch, and she wrapped her arms around him, and they sobbed together for 10 minutes. And I cried too. I had 10 minutes. What was I going to do? Frank ultimately returned the painting to Sophia, and she dug up a trove of old photos of Frank with her grandmother so that he could remember his family. Understand what happened here. We didn't make the common and easy mistake thinking that revenge is a motive. Instead, we went to the source of all human motivation, to the common needs. When Sophia understood that Frank had simply needed connection, human connection, and in particular to her grandmother, she got it. She could feel it. And then the magic. And then solutions.
People are weird and tricky, but it is so cool looking at someone and trying to figure out the way that they are and how they came to be. This clip, to me, was really cool because I just feel like there is so much to learn from human interactions, even if they seem so small or surface level. Larry gives us some great advice. If we ever want to know more about other people, a lot of the time we can just think about ourselves. We can look at what we would do in a situation or why we would do something. It's nearly impossible if we are being stubborn and are too attached to who we think we are. But his point is that everyone has the same set of motivations. I think this is troubling to grasp at first, but it seems true the more you look at it. Take, for example, a new gang member that might be being initiated into a gang, and a frat guy also being initiated into a fraternity, right? Their behaviors are different, with a gang's actions likely being more violent, and a frat's actions of initiation being more silly and, I guess, weird from the stories that I've heard. But the motivation of the member joining is the same. It is to connect with others and to feel a part of a community. Because in reality, no one wants to be alone, I think. While human behavior is complex and seems to rely on everything from who you grow up with, your social interactions, and just overall your experience, human motivation is different. It's simple. It is ingrained in everyone's DNA. All right, these clips were super, super interesting, and I absolutely had a blast putting them together for you guys. I am going to strive to have one episode out each month, like I said earlier. I'm slow, I know, but hopefully this process makes it easier for me to pump out work, and I just get more motivation to keep doing it, and I don't know, maybe keep doing a good job, and then be able to pump out more than one episode a month. That's the goal. If you want to watch or listen to the full versions of these clips, just hop over to the show notes, as that is where I will always provide the information to give the credit to the awesome folks who made this content. I hope you guys enjoyed, and if you have any feedback at all, seriously reach out and message me. I think it's going to be really cool the first time someone I don't know messages me about something that I talk about. That is going to be a really cool feeling. Anyways, Insta DM me or whatever. My handle is at Justin Chitla on the gram. I would like to hear what you guys are thinking. All right. See you next time.